First case for argument is EEOC versus Severn Trent. Severn Trent, Ms. Harris.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Judith Harris. I'm here on behalf of Severn Trent. Severn Trent Services has appealed the entry of a preliminary injunction by the district court below. It seeks to have that order reversed and to have the case dismissed.
Counsel, why have you appealed? What skin is this off Severn Trent's nose?
The skin off its nose is that, with respect to the order itself, Your Honor, it is unclear exactly what Severn Trent is prohibited from doing. Judge Gettleman's order provides that Severn Trent is enjoined from enforcing any agreement which does or purports to restrain Mr.
Yes, and in your reply brief, you say Severn Trent is not even a party to such an agreement.
That is correct.
And therefore, it's not, in Severn Trent's view, enjoined from anything, and therefore, it is, by your own view, completely legally irrelevant. So you're not adversely affected or aggrieved by this order, and why are you appealing?
Because we have an order that is directed to us, Your Honor.
Right, and but it doesn't stop you from doing anything you want to do. Right, suppose the district judge enters an order saying Severn Trent shall not erect a Christmas tree at the South Pole base in Antarctica. And you don't want to do that. Would you be appealing?
Perhaps not.
So why are you appealing this order, since you tell us that you were not a party to any agreement and therefore are utterly unaffected by the injunction?
The district court found us to be a successor to the
right,
party to the agreement.
Look, you're perfectly free to disclaim any reliance on the agreement, which you have now done.
But, Your Honor, I do not believe we are free to disregard an order which purports to run to us. And we seek legal
clarity. I guess I'm not making myself clear. This order blocks you from doing something which you tell us you have no legal right to do independent of the order. And therefore, it doesn't block you from doing anything.
But it seeks also to block other affiliates of Severn Trent from engaging in the enforcement of this provision. I mean, the practical effect, Your Honor, is that Severn Trent Services had a business relationship with Mr. Murphy. Mr. Murphy agreed to that provision and then sought to seek a waiver from the provision or an indemnification against any claim that could be made against him. The parties have other dealings. Severn Trent has dealings with Mr. Murphy. Frankly, separate and apart from this case, there are other proceedings in which they're involved.
Well, I thought your concern also was that suppose that when he's talking to the EEOC, he engages in some gratuitous slander of you. Wouldn't you still want to enforce the no disparagement clause against him?
Yes, Your Honor, and in fact...
How can you enforce it against him when you tell us it doesn't pertain to Severn Trent? Right. Before you filed your reply brief, you could have answered yes to that question. Once you filed your reply brief, you can't answer yes to that question.
But the order purports to run to Severn Trent, its affiliates, etc. Pitometer and whatever the successor to Pitometer is would ostensibly fall within that category. Severn Trent was before the court. You are correct, Your Honor, that we would want to be able to protect ourselves from any statements made that were gratuitous. We are not concerned about statements he makes that go to the merits of Ms. Pedelec's charge. Make that crystal clear. And we've said that before and encouraged the EEOC to issue a subpoena and bring him in. And in fact, he did go in to talk to them. What he said is unknown to us. And he told us that he went in and nothing happened to him. Now, whether he talked to them on the merits or didn't is not before the court. The EEOC has argued that he said nothing of substance. But he did go in to see the EEOC. Apparently, they want to continue to interview him. They aren't satisfied with whatever he said or didn't say, and they want to go forward. You see, they have a, Mr. Murphy had, and if there had been a hearing below, this could have all come out. But there was no hearing. There was no evidence adduced. Mr. Murphy and Severn Trent and other Severn Trent entities and related entities are in a commercial dispute separate and apart from this one. And what Severn Trent was concerned about was whether or not, in the context of those pieces of litigation, he might seek to assert that he is immune from any claims against us for conduct because he has gratuitously offered certain information which is unrelated to Ms. Petalik's charge, and we would be forced to defend those claims on that basis. That would not otherwise be the case if we had, if we were not enjoined from enforcing the provision.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, we seek to have the order reversed. Procedurally, we think it is defective in the sense that it fails to comply with Rule 65, doesn't set forth any findings of fact, it makes conclusions of law, it simply recites the 65A standards, makes no findings that would support the proposition that the EEOC's, or establishes evidence that bears on whether the EEOC's investigative process is interfered with. The EEOC relies heavily on the EEOC versus Astra case. We think it's distinguishable, as we have said in our brief. We believe that Astra deals with a situation in which the company made agreements with people who had filed charges or who had not filed EEOC charges, had said that they wanted those employees and former employees to refrain from cooperating with the EEOC in any investigation and to refrain from filing charges. It was very specific that they were trying to limit the ability of the EEOC to conduct an investigation. Here you're talking about an agreement that was made 3 years before, 2.5 years before the EEOC issued its subpoena, 3 years before we proceeded before the district court, was made in connection with a commercial transaction where Severn Trent purchased, Pacometer purchased the assets of Mr. Murphy's business and entered a consulting agreement with his consulting company to provide services. And so they are distinguishable on that basis. In addition, and we think those factual distinctions make for a different legal conclusion, that there is no harm to the EEOC. It could conduct its investigation. It could issue a subpoena, bring Mr. Murphy in. It did issue the subpoena. It could enforce the subpoena. And indeed, Judge Gettleman found, initially said below, that he was going to and was inclined to enforce the subpoena. I think the difference here is that in the between this case and Astra, is that in Astra, was very clear that the individuals who were to be investigated, who were to participate in the investigation, had information that bore on Ms. Petalik's complaint, and it was their concern was about whether or not disclosing that information violated the agreements they had made. The court in the First Circuit upheld the district court in its finding that that did interfere with the EEOC's investigation, and for that reason, the injunction should issue. Here, Mr. Murphy has a lot of information about Severn Trent. This order gives him the ability to go before the EEOC, even if they don't ask him, to say all kinds of things. He may say them in an effort to prove that he is credible.
Well, the injunction says it refers to providing information, testimony, and documents to the EEOC, quote, in connection therewith. That is, and that's a reference to the charge. What would be, in your view, better language than in connection therewith?
Your Honor, it is very difficult to know without knowing what it is that Mr. Murphy would say. That's the problem here.
Well, but look, your argument is that instead of entering this injunction, the court should have enforced a subpoena, which you say would have given this man testimonial immunity for whatever he said. Would there be any material difference between enforcing the subpoena and this injunction for purposes of providing testimonial immunity for whatever is said to the EEOC?
I think the difference is that, well, I think no, but the difference is the effect on Severn Trent. Because if we err in terms of seeking to enforce our rights elsewhere, we would be subject to proceedings before the district court for violation, contempt proceedings for having violated this injunction. That's precisely one of the issues. We cannot tell what conduct it is that we might engage in that would be violative of this injunction.
And what would happen if the subpoena were enforced?
The subpoena were enforced, he would be required to testify. And that would be the end of it.
And if you attempted to penalize that testimony, you would be, I assume, engaged in the obstruction of justice.
If we,
which is not a position you want to find yourself in any more than contempt of court.
If we intended to pursue our legal rights elsewhere, which is what our concern is, if he oversteps what we think are proper bounds, we would not be in contempt because the subpoena would.
No, look. Just listen to what I said. I didn't say contempt if you attempt to penalize testimony given in response to the subpoena. I said obstruction of justice.
We would not. I do not believe we would be in a situation where we would be obstructing justice, because he would have been subpoenaed. He would have testified. He would have already given his testimony to the EEOC. We would not be obstructing their process, and we would not be obstructing his cooperation with the EEOC.
I don't think you would want to be in a position of having the federal government charge you with penalizing somebody, imposing a financial penalty on account of testimony he gave in response to a judicially enforced subpoena. That kind of behavior doesn't come cheap.
Right.
Your position seems to be that you can do anything you want in response to that. And that sounds to me like a good reason why Severn Trent should be enjoined, not like a good reason why the injunction should be vacated.
I do not believe that I was arguing that Severn Trent can do anything that it wants.
But then let's come back to my question. What is it that, in your view, Severn Trent is prohibited from doing by this injunction that it would be allowed to do to this man if he testified pursuant to a subpoena?
First of all, Severn Trent would not, in either event, be going after him in any way for testimony that related to Ms. Petalik's charge, that bore on the substance of her charge. The concern of Severn Trent is that he will make all kinds of statements, and the concern is not unfounded, and if we had had a hearing, we would have been able to present this. The concern is not unfounded, because he had already made remarks which one might characterize as disparaging to Severn Trent and threaten to make them elsewhere about matters unrelated to Ms. Petalik.
Okay, you want to save the rest of your time, Ms. Harris, for rebuttal?
Yes, Judge Posner.
Ms. Occhialino?
May it please the Court, I'm Ann Noel Occhialino, and I represent the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And then the Commission requests that this Court find that the District Court did not abuse its discretion in issuing the injunction. I'd like to address several points that my opponent brought up. And the first was, my opponent contended that the injunction does not sufficiently describe in detail the acts that are sought to be restrained. But in their reply brief at page 4 and footnote 4, they say that they're not complaining about that. It's been the Commission's understanding that their complaint about the Rule 65D compliance goes to
the
lack of.
Well, I think they're also complaining. Just why were they enjoined? Why the injunction when the EEOC could get this fellow's testimony by subpoena?
Even if the EEOC were to go to court and enforce a subpoena against Mr. Murphy, I don't think that Severn Trent would be any. There would be no protection for him, an added protection, by having to go to court and answer the subpoena. Severn Trent could still go to court and sue him for breach of the non-disparagement clause. So the EEOC is puzzled about.
Wait, could sue him for breach of the clause even if he were just testifying in response to a subpoena?
If you're testifying under judicial compulsion in response to a subpoena, obviously can't be penalized in separate private litigation.
Well, Severin Trent seems to be concerned that he's going to say things to the EEOC during its investigation that go beyond the investigation and are disparaging to Severin Trent. Well, if he's still testifying under the subpoena, he could testify to matters that are malicious or slander or violate the disparagement clause, and they could still go after him for that.
If he gives an immaterial answer in response to the subpoena, that's not protected. But so far as I can tell from this injunction, if he gives an immaterial answer that's not related to the EEOC's investigation, then the injunction doesn't bear on this either.
Well, it's my understanding...
Look, your adversary couldn't articulate the difference between a subpoena and an injunction for this purpose. Could you perhaps articulate this difference?
About if the subpoena was enforced?
What are the circumstances under which, if this man testified and gave material responses under a subpoena, what are the circumstances under which he could nonetheless be penalized later in a contract action that the injunction would prohibit such a penalty?
We think that there are none. We think that once...
You think there are none. The other side thinks there are none. So why are we here?
It's my understanding that the difference between the EEOC's view and Severin Trent's is that we think he has an absolute privilege to talk to us about anything related to the charge, and that they think that whatever he testifies about has to be strictly related to the charge. But
Wait. You said it has to be related, and they say it has to be strictly related?
Yeah. Your Honor, we think that we should be able to go in and talk to him about anything.
No, you don't really think that, right?
That he has an absolute privilege to talk to us about anything related.
About anything? About it, even if it's completely unrelated?
Well, we think we're bound by the charge from Congress, which is just to investigate charges of discrimination.
Yes, but what if he wants to talk to you about something completely unrelated?
Yes. You ask him about this charge of discrimination, and he says in response, "Now let me tell you the plans for our anti-ballistic missile system." Right? This will be of great interest in North Korea. And he details our anti-ballistic missile system. That, I assume, is not covered by a witness privilege.
I think that this EEOC cited two cases. One was Medina versus Spotnail. One was Stiff versus Chadbourne. They talk about an absolute privilege for participation, and one was an EEOC fact-finding conference.
For material testimony, not for...
But who's to decide what's material? What if we talk to Mr. Murphy and he says... Well, I know that they didn't fire Ms. Petalik.
But the problem is your position would justify you in always seeking an injunction, regardless of whether there was an anti-disparagement provision, because you could always argue, well, you know, they might retaliate against him in some fashion.
Your Honor, I understand your question to go to the concern. Well,
let me put it this way. Where did Judge Gettleman explain the difference between a subpoena and an injunction, why in this particular case the injunction was necessary?
I think that he did address that. He talked more about the reasons why we shouldn't have to enforce a subpoena against him. He said that Mr. Murphy's just willing to talk to us, and why should he? And he's afraid he's going to be hammered by Severin Trent. I think that was his language. So why should he be dragged into court and have to defend himself against a subpoena?
Your whole purpose is to protect him, protect Mr. Murphy?
No, our purpose is...
Well, why, if it's not the case, why the injunction?
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misunderstood your question. Our purpose is to protect Mr. Murphy so that we can protect the integrity of our investigation.
No, but look what you're saying. You're saying you would prefer not to subpoena people, right?
Yes.
Okay, but that argument is too broad. That would say in every case what you want to do is first get an injunction saying that the employer can't, you know, retaliate or punish or sue or what have you, someone who talks to you. And then you'll be able to talk to this person without subpoenaing him. It's a very strange argument. We're going to have injunctions coming out of our ears.
I don't think so, Your Honor. This case is not just about the exception.
What's unusual? Right, it is unusual. This is an unusual injunction. So the question is, what did Judge Gettleman say that would justify the injunction?
About going through the four prongs, or I understand your...
Forget the four prongs, for God's sake. What practical reason did he give why an injunction is necessary here?
Because Severin Trent...
Do you think it's necessary whenever there's an anti-disparagement?
No,
problem?
I think that it's Severin Trent's refusal to assure...
Did he explain that? Did he say they've refused to assure...
At the June 16th hearing, I'm looking at my notes, and I think it might have been page 5 of the appendix that is attached to Severn Trent's opening brief. He said the defendants basically conceded and intended to use the contract to keep Mr. Murphy from going beyond the legitimate bounds of the investigation.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Well, I guess this goes back to our point.
Who wants to go? You don't want to go beyond the You don't want Mr. Murphy to go beyond the legitimate bounds of the investigation.
No, but the non-disparagement clause is very broad. It says anything that might deprecate
It's very broad, but I think we've all agreed it's not so broad that it would forbid him to talk about the charge, right?
Well, what if Mr. Murphy was talking to us and he said, made comments about one of the allegations in the case is pornography, and said, yeah, you know, I knew all the supervisors at Severn Trent were looking at pornography on the web. I mean, that's a comment that could be seen as violating the non-disparagement clause. So when Mr. Murphy sits down to talk to us, is he supposed to just parse out what he's going to say that might be actionable on the non-disparagement clause as opposed to what might not be actionable because it's directly related to the charge? I mean, the court also said that it didn't want to have to sit down with him while...
But how do you know that Severn Trent is going to take any action? Did they communicate in any way that they would take action?
They did not explicitly threaten Mr. Murphy, and we can see that. But we think that there was...
How did EEOC get involved in protecting Mr. Murphy?
Well, we tried to talk to Mr. Murphy, and he said, I can't talk to you because I tried to talk to Severn Trent and asked for assurance they wouldn't sue me under the non-disparagement clause. So then we stepped in and we sent a letter to Severn Trent in December of 2002 and asked for their assurance that they wouldn't sue him. And then in district court again, we said if they will just agree in open court that they will not sue him for any information he gives us during our
investigation. No. Any information is too broad, right? Any information related to the charge.
Who decides what information
is related? No, wait a second. Did you ask them for a blanket assurance?
I think that when you read...
Did you ask them for a blanket assurance that they would not sue him no matter what he said to you?
I interpret the comment...
Did you not?
Yes, at the June 3rd hearing.
Yes, well, then you're not entitled to this injunction.
Well, we disagree. What about
the... Well, I think you're completely wrong. Because you asked for too much.
Well, the district court said, though, how is it... Who's going to decide what's
you
really related?
You asked for too much. If you said, look, will you assure us that you will not enforce this clause if against Mr. Murphy as long as what he says is related, you could say loosely related, arguably related to the subject matter of your investigation, that would be one thing. Apparently you didn't do that.
Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry that you disagree with the EEOC's position.
I gather that White said that he sought assurances. Do we know what assurances he sought?
I don't know the specifics about
Is it in the record?
About what kind of assurance he sought?
Yes, I gather he sent a letter to Severn Trent asking for assurances. Is that letter in the record?
No.
So I get back to my question about why you're protecting Mr. Murphy.
Why we're protecting him?
Mm-hmm.
Because we think every witness should be protected and feel free
to
talk to us.
Well, in this particular case, what indication that he will suffer adversely because he answered your subpoena and testified?
I think it's the refusal of Severn Trent to assure him that it won't.
And who said that?
They have never explicitly stated that. But the law does.
And you don't have the letter that he purportedly sent them in the record?
No.
How do you know that they said even said they wouldn't?
Well, that was exactly the same answer they gave us when we sent our letter and in open court.
Your letter was too broad, right? We've
Your Honor has said that it was too broad.
Is the EEOC's letter in the record?
Yes.
Okay, so
and the response.
We can take a look at that for ourselves.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I just wanted to say. The law does have this concept of a refusal to reassure somebody in contract area. If you refuse to assure somebody when you think there's going to be a breach, we think it's a similar position here. It's not just every disparagement, anti-disparagement clause that exists is going to give rise to this kind of a lawsuit.
Could you have sought a declaratory judgment?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't think that we could have sought a declaratory judgment since the EEOC is not involved in the...
Well, you're very involved with Mr. Murphy's side of the issue, though, aren't you?
We're very involved in our investigation of Ms. Pedelec's charge. Congress told us to investigate charges, and that's what we're trying to do. That's all. If this court has no further questions, we can ask that you affirm the district court's injunctive order.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Okilana. Ms. Harris, how much time does she have? 2 minutes?
I think I have more, Your Honor. And unless my opponent's comments have raised questions that you want to put to me, I've concluded my remarks.
Well, we say I haven't looked at this letter from the EEOC. Did they ask for you to assure them that whatever he said would be, or did they say whatever would be related to the charge?
I believe the letter is broad. I have it. I left it over on the table, but I believe it's broad language. It's not limited to what he says related to the charge.
And what was your response?
That we were unwilling to waive the provision, because that's what they were asking for, was a waiver of the provision with respect to Mr. Murphy.
Did you indicate you would look at something reduced, lesser?
We've tried throughout this process. We had 3 hearings before Judge Gettleman. There were 3 different Mondays, I believe, each a week apart. And in the interim, we were trying to negotiate language. And we were unable to reach an agreement because of the fact that 2 things. 1, they wanted an injunction. And 2, the breadth of what they wanted was quite great.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Harris and Ms. Fofilano.